Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'll be speaking today with Edward Morgan about his 2010 book, What Really Happened to the 1960s, How Mass Media Culture Failed American Democracy. And you can learn more at Ted Morgan, one word, tedmorgan.blogspot.com, tedmorgan.blogspot.com. On Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at politics, economics, environment, science, health, and more, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. The show airs as specials on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn.com, and podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, Podomatic.com, most major podcast sites, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net. TerrenceMcNally.net. Anyone who listens to this show may know that my worldview, my take on things, my sense of what's possible, as well as my sense of what stands in the way, my skepticism, as well as my hope, are rooted in my experience of what we call the 60s. I was born in 1948 in New Bedford, Mass., a poor gray town that lost its textile mills to right-to-work states in the South. My family moved, first to Texas, then settling in Florida. I entered first grade in Miami in 1954, the year of Brown versus Board of Education. I graduated from high school, the high school closest to Cape Canaveral, in 1965 at the height of the space program. The school was integrated in my sophomore year, 8 blacks out of 2,500 students. I learned of JFK's assassination in 6th period algebra class and RFK's at 3 in the morning while tripping on LSD in a college dorm. I'm Harvard class of 69, the year of the anti-war strike. And I spent the next few years, through Nixon's resignation and our exit from Vietnam, which I think of as the end of the 60s, well outside the mainstream. I started an alternative high school. I worked for the McGovern campaign. I lived in and out of my van for a couple of years, sailed the Atlantic, farmed organically, adopted lifelong yoga and meditation practices, and produced a documentary on Buckminster Fuller. Those who listen regularly have heard this before. I'm going to spell out here my vision of a movement that I call 60s 2.0. And the more time I spend with young people these days, the more I get the feeling that some of the questions and values that emerged in the 1960s are quite alive in them today. And I believe they stand a chance to build something deeper and more sustainable this time with the help of technology, demographics, and a bit of cultural and social evolution. First, technology. The internet, for all its faults, makes it easier to reduce material consumption, to interact with diverse others unbound by geography, and to organize rapidly and efficiently. Second, the greatly expanded talent pool. Leadership in the 60s was dominated by males, and except for race-defined organizations, overwhelmingly white. Today, we can tap the genius and energy not only of women, but of so many others whose voices were not heard back then. Third, I joke that in the 60s, there were 100 beatniks in San Francisco and 100 in Greenwich Village, and other than that, we were on our own. Today, millions of my generation and older welcome and support young people. In the face of our endangered democracy, obscene inequality, systemic injustice, pandemics, and climate change, I envision an energized, engaged, and effective, intentionally multi-generational alliance that is finally able to tip things in the right direction and do it in time. Today is one of a number of conversations I'm having to learn more and to test my ideas with some who've thought about this more than I have. A few weeks ago, I talked with Bill McKibben about an organization he's working to grow called Third Act, about mobilizing boomers to join with young people. In a few weeks, I'll talk with David and Margaret Talbot about their new book, By the Light of Burning Dreams, The Triumphs and Tragedies of the Second American Revolution, their book on the 60s. And when I shared my vision with Rob Johnson of the Institute of New Economic Thinking, he suggested I read a few books. And today's guest wrote one of them, What Really Happened to the 1960s. In Morgan's look at mass media's depiction of the 1960s, he seeks to explain both what actually happened and then what happened to how we remember it. He reveals how the mass media have shaped the popular image, the meaning, and the value of that political and cultural decade. Introducing Morgan in 2011, Mark Crispin Miller put it this way: a genuine moment of democratic rebellion has been caricatured, distorted, and translated as a moment of generational brattiness and best forgotten. The book provides a compelling explanation for how American society changed from rising impulses for greater participatory democracy to one of the opposite, neoliberal capitalism combined with growing authoritarianism. Edward Morgan, also known as Ted, and that's what the way I'll address him for the rest of this conversation, is Emeritus Distinguished University Professor at Lehigh University, having served there from 1976 through 2016. He's author also of The 60s Experience, Hard Lessons About Modern America. Welcome, Ted Morgan, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work.
Thank you, Terrence. Pleasure to be here.
And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Wednesday, December 15th. Ted, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So I offered a little bit about you, but I want to know more about your path. How do you tell your story to the work you've done over the years and where you find yourself today? And feel free to go way back, mentors, turning points, moments of decision, that sort of thing.
Well, I guess I'd start with my childhood in South Hadley, Massachusetts, a little college town. My dad was actually a professor at Mount Holyoke. And I think my parents gave me a very strong passion for democracy. My dad was a town meeting member. He admired sort of popular democracy. He admired Jefferson's vision of that. And my mom was just a wonderfully open to everybody and loving person that I think gave me sort of a personal side to that vision. When I went off to college, I will say that during my high school years, they were marked by very early civil rights activism, the Freedom Rides, the sit-ins, and so on, and the March on Washington, and also Kennedy's assassination. So I went off to college. I went to Oberlin College in 1964, and that was the year that that summer was Freedom Summer, when many students from the North, mostly white, went south to help in voter registration drive and experienced just how horrific conditions were for black Americans in Mississippi, and were for the most part very radicalized by that. Several of those people returned to campus at Oberlin. There were several who came from Oberlin.
Oberlin has a great history with civil rights. It actually was a stop on the Underground Railroad.
Yeah, very true. And we are probably reminded of that when we're attending Oberlin. The people that came back from Mississippi became sort of a phalanx that helped to really politicize the campus far more than it had been. And I was drawn into that. I ran for student council at the time, and that was a group that included a lot of those people returning from Mississippi, so it was fairly leftish, let's say. And I would say that over those years, I was greatly influenced by my peers, several of whom were more clearly tuned into what was going on in the activist world, also had insights into what the United States was doing, for example, in Vietnam before I knew much at all about Vietnam. And just to tell a little story, I remember my freshman year when Lyndon Johnson began the escalation in North Vietnam. There was a small little rally. This is February 65. A little rally on campus with about 20 people or so, and they all, well, to my naive eyes, they looked kind of like Greenwich Village beatniks. And I sort of thought to myself, well, what do these people, why do they think they know more about Southeast Asia than, say, people on the State Department? And I actually went back to my room with a few of my friends who were probably more conservative than I was, And I made a sign, and I came back, and I was a counter-protester.
Oh, my God.
Said, here's one young Democrat who supports the Democratic administration.
Wow.
And what happened to me then was that I decided I was going to pay a lot more attention to this. And, I didn't know if I was right or wrong, really. But so I enrolled in a course on the Vietnam War, started reading stuff that these friends had been reading, and I would say by the fall when I came back in sophomore year, I was what was called a dove. Fairly quickly on, I became more profoundly against the war, in which I saw, which I came to see as an act of American aggression against people that were posed no threat to the United States. They were the ones who were systematically being crushed by the United States. Before my senior year, that summer was the summer of course, each of the summers had been summers of long, hot summers of riots, beginning with Harlem in 64, but mainly Watts, which captured media attention in 65, and then Huff in Chicago, South Side in 66, and Newark and Detroit in 67, the summer of 67. And I remember feeling that summer that it really felt like the system, our country was really falling apart, both because of the war and because of what was happening in the inner cities. I had filed for a conscientious objector status, and I became a CO with another kind of bizarre encounter with my draft board that summer after I graduated. And I worked for 2 years in Boston area hospitals as a conscientious objector doing alternate service. So that kind of is a lot of where I came from. I would say during the 1980s, while I was teaching at Lehigh, when the United States was very involved in really violently subverting the Sandinista government in Nicaragua and supporting a despotic military regime in El Salvador and Guatemala, I really began to see American foreign policy as a systemic problem, not just a case of mistakes here or mistakes there. And so that, I think that kind of defined my, what I would call my radicalism or my system critical perspective. So that maybe gives you enough, by the way.
Yeah, no, that's great. I mean, in some ways, I gave a lot of my background and you gave yours, and I entered college in 65. So we're... Uh-huh. We're 1 year.
A year behind me.
Yeah. We're very close. I recall at the moment that you were counter-protesting on campus at Oberlin, I think, would have been the year that I was at Boys State, Florida, and run by the American Legion, and not sure at all how I felt about the war in Vietnam.
Yeah, I think that's very typical that most people had very little clue of what, I mean, it was presented in the media as a crisis. The United States was in a crisis trying to counteract the forces of communism. And so what else did we know unless we started to dig and talk to people that knew other things were happening?
For some reason, for me, the fog also comes from, first there was something going on in Laos, some country that I'd never heard of. And then there was something going on in Vietnam, another country I'd never heard of. And it all just seemed very far away, and your question, as you said, that occurred to you, which is what makes these people think they know more than the people in the know, than the State Department, than these people that had been through the Eisenhower administration, I think, and the Kennedy administration, as, you know, these were the legit leaders and the best and the brightest and all of that. So I think that it was... Yeah. A slow process. Now, one thing that you've pointed out is that the civil rights movement was different. There, you could see that you knew something that Bull Connor didn't, or Orville Faubus didn't, or George Wallace didn't. That you know that these people were equal. And I think it's interesting when the country and the movements begin to make a shift from civil rights to Vietnam, and then as you go through in your book, so many other causes, whether it's women or environment or all of those sorts of things. So let me ask you, how this book happened. This book came out in 2010. As I said, I only discovered it recently as a personal recommendation when I was talking about my interest in how do we make, are there lessons to be learned from the 60s? How do we bring boomers who may have been active in the 60s, activate them so they can join with young people who are dealing with climate and who are dealing with racial justice and all of those sorts of things. But how did you tell us also what that earlier book about the 60s was and how this one happened.
Okay, that's a lot. Actually, what I wanted to just interject very quickly is,
sure.
This is particularly, I just mentioned this largely for younger listeners, that about the context of what we were talking about with respect to the Vietnam War. We all grew up in a world which celebrated again and again through and through the U.S. role in World War II.
Yep.
And I remember as a Boy Scout marching in Memorial Day bands and feeling very proud and so forth. And so what happened with Vietnam is we went into that assuming the same kind of phenomenon where it was happening until we found out otherwise. Young people today or 10 years ago or 15 years ago have lived through other wars which have been, you know, disastrous as well. And so I think may have a hard time understanding why people weren't quick to oppose the Vietnam War quicker than they were. And one of the interesting phenomena is that this will get to my book, is that the anti-war movement in the 60s started tiny. And it grew huge, and it grew incredibly more militant, at least in parts. The anti-war movement that began in 2003 when the United States invaded or was about to invade Iraq was the largest global anti-war movement ever.
Yep.
Massive movement. Millions of people on the streets of New York and Madrid and London and so forth. But that movement got smaller and quieter.
Yes.
And eventually faded from view. And I think that that's a very important distinction because in getting smaller, it lost the ability to keep the pressure on American foreign policy that it needs to have. And there are a lot of media reasons for that, which we could maybe talk about later.
Yeah, yeah. Well, also, there is the thing that worldwide protest had zero effect.
We didn't protest
at the start of the Vietnam War. So that we could have seen that we were ignored and rebuffed and so on and go home with our tails between our legs. But with the Iraq, you know, we didn't start protesting until it had grown. But with the Iraq War, the protests happened before and they made no difference. And I think, you know, that also has such a significant thing. I'm going to jump to something that I plan to say later, but I watched a talk you gave in 2011, soon after the book came out. And in it, you talked about a course you taught at Lehigh on movements and on the 60s and so on, and how a very common response of your students was, I feel those same values, I feel those same urges, but I don't see any place for me to go, any way for me to make a difference about any of it.
Yeah, very true. Well, you're mentioning that brings me back to your question about my two books related to the 60s. And the first one, which is The 60s Experience, Hard Lessons About Modern America, was my effort to make sense of the 60s. And it happened late in my first sabbatical that I got this idea for making sense of the 60s and wanted to start writing about it, but I had a lot of reading to do. And my sabbatical was ending, so that was going to be a lot harder. So I decided I would teach a course called, at that point, Politics of the 1960s. It later became Social Movements and Legacies of the 1960s. And I taught that for about 35 years.
Wow.
And so that led to my writing the book, and then that book came out. Well, during that time, it was the 1980s, which is when Central America was happening, and I was reading a lot of Chomsky, and I was reading a lot about the media and the way the media, including the New York Times, the mainstream media, basically, was characterizing what the United States was doing was the exact opposite of what I think the United States was in fact doing. So the argument was we were supporting a fledgling democracy in El Salvador, and we were trying to stop a Soviet puppet totalitarian government in Nicaragua. And we could go on about that.
Yeah.
I'll leave that for now. But what that did is it made me very conscious of the media. And it's from that point on, I started looking at the media and writing about the media. And it became pretty clear to me that at the same time, the media were doing a job on the 1960s and transforming it into something quite different from what I had been writing about in my earlier book. So that then led eventually, about 11 years of effort, to the book called What Really Happened to the 1960s.
Okay, and in What Really Happened, as I said in the introduction, you talk about what really happened, but you also, the thread there, why it's about the media, is the power that the mass media had to change, to influence what actually happened. You mm-hmm. say that
very important.
The media can inspire activism. It can. But mm-hmm. then ultimately mm-hmm. what it did to define the 60s and ultimately to minimize it. And talk to, yes. you know, I'll really give you the floor now to really talk about that, what's at the kernel, the sort of the heart of the book, what really happened.
Well, talking about how the media dealt with the movements during the 60s is the first part of the book. And the key characteristics of the mass media, by mass media, I mean essentially, you know, what we think of typically as the media, the national newspapers, the national television networks, etc. They are largely defined and became increasingly defined on the one hand by what I call the boundaries of legitimate discourse or legitimate points of view, things that are considered worth taking seriously, points of view that are worth taking seriously. And those did not include, they excluded, they did not take seriously views from any of the movements of the 1960s that were more systemically critical. Views of the Vietnam War as an immoral act of U.S. aggression, that was not in the mainstream media. That was not in the Dove or liberal columnists of the New York Times writings, for example. Those views saw the war as an error, a mistake, a good intentions gone awry, things of that nature. At the same time, the media would include points of view that were damning the movements of the 1960s, critics from the right, for example. So you can essentially think of the mass media as being defined, the legitimate conversation being defined as between Democrats and Republicans, whatever the era might be. Views from outside that are not taken seriously and are largely excluded from the mass media. So the second characteristic, which became increasingly important, was the visual nature of the media as television loomed larger and larger in most people's lives, defining what they saw or heard about as news. And what happened was that the images themselves had sort of a binary effect. That is, on the one hand, the images would make people who might be sympathetic to what they saw aware that something was happening that maybe they wanted to be part of too. So it could be an invitation for others to join in the kinds of activism. A classic example would be, for instance, the Birmingham March in Birmingham, Alabama, 1963, when the police used police dogs against the marchers, they fire hosed them and so forth. And what the media showed were images that, to Northern Americans in particular, told them what the civil rights movement was about. The authorities of the South were crushing people who were peacefully asking for their legitimate American rights. And so that image itself mobilized a lot of support for the civil rights movement in the North, including that of President Kennedy eventually.
Mm-hmm.
That's one side of the images. They can invite people to behave, join in, etc., behave like the others they're seeing in the media and so on. The other side of the images, of course, is that as people, as activists began to feel more and more that their views were not taken seriously, they started to be more prone to the invitation to act visually in ways that would be dramatic, provocative, etc. And so the media shut out the more, let's say, radical points of view in the anti-war movement, in the Black Power movement, in the women's movement, and instead, the cameras were drawn like magnets to the behaviors or the people's appearances that seemed to be most striking, dramatic, provocative, what have you.
You said the media ignored the more radical aspects. And one of the points that you make, and it's worth reminding listeners, is that radical does not mean militant. Militant means militant.
Yes.
Radical, and I'm quoting you here, fundamentally critical of institutions and the way those institutions are a fundamental reason why we have systemic and consistent problems. So one of the things I'm reminded of is that radical, the Latin root actually comes from root. And so radical is the root cause. Radical is the deeper cause. And what the media was ignoring, they were loving the militancy that made good pictures. They were ignoring the root causes.
Yes. Thank you for pointing that out. In fact, they called the militant actions radical.
I'm just going to remind people what you said was that if you find that your real arguments, your real justifications, your real analysis does not make the news, but what does is the visually exciting things you do, then if you want to for the media to cover you, you begin to gravitate toward more and more of that. And so the media creates a feedback loop in which what they show becomes what you do, and then they define what that means.
Yes, exactly right. And that, of course, became very useful to the revival of the right.
Mm-hmm. A couple of things that you said in the book when we're laying out these sections that I want to focus a little bit more on. One is you write about how the movements of the 60s challenged American hegemony as well as how the media supported it. And you actually, I thought I knew what hegemony meant, but I think I didn't know the nuances. Could you define hegemony and then expand on that perspective just a bit?
Well, I guess I'm using it in two respects there. American hegemony refers to the United States' domination of much world.
And that was all I knew.
Hegemony, it's...
That was the only meaning I knew.
Uh-huh. Well, the other meaning comes from Antonio Gramsci, who is an Italian Marxist writing in the earlier part of the 20th century, in which he talks about how the media, rather than using force to crush people, the media and the leaders and legitimate leaders and so on shape public opinion, shape public beliefs, so that people beliefs are constrained in ways that support the system, even if that system is working against their interest.
Right, right. I mean, you'd spoken about it before. I just thought for other people who, like I, had fallen into thinking all it meant was domination, that there is this more subtle meaning, that it is the definition of what's acceptable and what's respectable and what's legitimate and so on. And if you can limit that to what perpetuates your system, that's a much more subtle way to create hegemony.
Yeah, may I read you a couple of sentences about
Absolutely.
That from the book? Hegemony occurs via the penetration throughout the culture of an ideology, a belief system that this is the way things are. To the degree that the way things are becomes the way things must or should be in the popular imagination, the relations of domination and power in society are legitimized. Hegemony is maintained through a never-ending process of, quote, negotiation, in which elites anticipate and seek to incorporate the very forces that rise up to challenge them or potentially might do so.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you. This is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking today with Ted Morgan about his 2010 book, What Really Happened to the 60s, How Mass Media Culture Failed American Democracy. Learn more about his work and see his opinion pieces over the years at Ted Morgan, one word, tedmorgan.blogspot.com, tedmorgan.blogspot.com. And another thing that you mentioned peripherally, but I wanted to focus on a little bit more, was this distinction between the civil rights movement and the later movements, that for America as a national audience, civil rights was about the South. So national media went along with it. But as other movements emerged, they're no longer about the regressive South that you want to bring into the hegemony, sort of, or the mainstream picture of what America is. That you point out that was, even though it took protests and it took, you know, all of that, it was basically to bring them into the larger fold. But once the movement started challenging the system, then the media, that's when the media came up with the generational frame.
And partly because that people were beginning to feel less hopeful as they did that and saw how the system was responding, you had the beginnings of what became the counterculture, of people starting to drop out and just behave and look in ways that clearly did not fit into the mainstream. And the media paid enormous amounts of attention to that phenomenon.
Southern whites are on the wrong end of the civil rights movement. But then, and this is a quote from you, the media facilitated backlash to the other rising currents, led the white South and much of the white working class into the right-wing dominated Republican electoral camp, while the Democrats moved systematically into the corporate center, which is where we find our politics today, a partisan divide between neo-fascism on the right and corporate centrism masquerading as the left.
In terms of that backlash, you can see how, it runs directly to Donald Trump, but it starts really with, probably with Barry Goldwater, actually, when he runs for president in 64. And he argues that there's a small riot in Harlem, and he equates the riot in Harlem, which is seen and reported on to some degree in the news, he equates it with the civil rights movement in the South, because the civil rights movement, by practicing civil disobedience, was teaching or preaching what Goldwater called disrespect for the law. And that's the way people in Harlem were behaving, with disrespect for the law. And so by making that, he starts to feed on the white, especially poorer white, backlash in the South to the civil rights movement. And as the first Republican to win four or five Southern states in the 64 election against Lyndon Johnson, since going back before Reconstruction, or to Reconstruction, probably.
And Nixon and Kevin Phillips pick this up, and this becomes the Southern strategy that Nixon uses and then lays the groundwork for everything up until Trump and beyond. I want to briefly move in a few minutes to talking about where we stand today, right? And whether there's merit in my thinking about boomers and millennials and Gen Zs and younger and so on. But first, I just want to give you some of your chapter headings and give us the sort of the cliff notes of what you're talking about there. We've already talked kind of how one chapter is media militancy and violence, the making of bad 60s icons. That's kind of the outgrowth of what we were just talking about. They feature the other. They define these young people as young people and as some sort of other, and dismiss them and minimize them in that way. Another chapter is called Domesticating the 60s, Capitalism's Cultural Co-optation. What's that about?
I'm glad that's what I was actually going to go to next, too.
Oh, great.
Well, the other side of all of this, the right-wing backlash to the violence and youth and so forth, is that the the mass media, the commercial media, including Madison Avenue, start to discover this youth phenomenon, the baby boom phenomenon of all of these young people who seem statistically in public opinion polls and so on to have a different set of values and orientations from the mainstream and are sort of preaching freedom and equality and personal development or something of that nature. And they realize quickly, this is a huge untapped market. And so Madison Avenue starts to pitch advertisements aimed at youth.
Thomas Frank's book, Conquest of the Cool. Which basically is, the whole book is about what we're talking about right now, which how they commodified, that things were, you'd have a car sold as part of a revolution, right?
So Frank's book talks a lot about that in terms of advertising. Mark Crispin Miller wrote a book called Boxed In, which is about how television entertainment or television shows do some of the same thing. And he's got this brilliant essay called Big Brother Is You Watching, in which he essentially makes the argument that television sucks us in, seduces us, so that we, with essentially what he and Frank call hipness, by showing shows that are sort of about young people, like Smothers Brothers show, sort of playing a bit to young youth culture in the 60s and so on. But Miller talks about this a lot more with respect to the book 1984 and how instead of being a totalitarian system which is spying on us, this will sound a little interesting today, but spying on us and seeing us in all of our privacy lives and controlling us completely, it's having essentially the same effect through our own volition, because we choose it. We watch television and feel that we are superior to the characters in the sitcoms, and therefore it's flattering us and sort of keeping us there in front of the television to absorb all the advertising messages and everything else, as well as become less physically active in the world.
Yeah, less of a citizen and more of a consumer.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, and it seems to me, by the way, one thing, Ted, it seems to me that that strain that Crispin Miller is talking about at that point transforms a bit, but grows enormously if you consider the internet.
Absolutely, yeah. I think the crucial thing the internet does is, well, crucial thing it does is it allows us to tune into only the things we want to see, hear, and so on. So it sort of structurally reinforces people essentially existing within enclaves of largely like-minded others. And so that reinforces greatly the sort of fragmentation of society, which we obviously can see all around us today.
That's right. So that even if you leave out the part of misinformation and that sort of thing that we know the internet does to disrupt and weaken democracy, just the separation and the creation of these smaller internet communities, that already weakens democracy, right? You are no longer part of a larger society where others are on your, are to be considered in your opinions and decisions.
Yeah, right. One thing I do mention in the book is how the backlash culture and the television culture converge. And one of the examples that I give is Forrest Gump, which aired, I believe, in around 90 or 91 initially. So it comes on the heels of the Reagan era, which Reagan is blaming the 60s for everything and talking about, young drug-crazed people and so forth. And The Big Chill gives us a picture. Sorry, The Big Chill. Forrest Gump gives us a picture that completely mirrors that view of the 60s. You have sort of the good 60s, which the right acknowledges somewhat reluctantly, perhaps, that was the Kennedy years and the early civil rights movement. And then the bad 60s are, and that is presented in the film by inserting Forrest Gump in black and white footage of those events. The rest of the film is acted out, the bad 60s, when Forrest Gump starts to, goes to Vietnam, among other things, and all you see in Vietnam is the Americans who are blasted by Vietnam, what looks like napalm, being fired by the Vietnamese. You don't see anything, which, of course, the Americans were using against.
Yeah.
So just to cut this short, but you see the Panthers, like black militant group. You sort of see the white SDS leader who is dating Gump's friend, Jenny. And he abuses her, and he calls the soldiers who are gathering for a Memorial Day killers, you know, baby killers,
yep.
and so forth. He's abusive. So he represents the kind of picture of the white activists of the era in the Reagan view. And it goes on, you know, and then Jenny gets involved in drugs and the counterculture and then ultimately dies of AIDS. And meanwhile, the right-wing people like Myron Magnin are writing books about how the 60s produced AIDS, which is, you know, on the face of it, absurd. So what is happening here is exactly what our media culture is like today. It's rife with completely counterfactual, inaccurate, untrue beliefs that are just taken seriously by millions of people.
Can you, so here's a question that I hadn't even thought of before, but just strikes me. Can you talk a little bit about why Reagan was perfect for his moment and why Trump is so powerful in this moment? How does that fit into, because they're very different, but they play on the same fears and the same dissatisfactions.
Well, Reagan came across on TV as this sort of jovial, benign uncle. And on the one hand, denounces, preaches essentially conservative values, denouncing the 60s, praising the years before the 60s when we went off the rails in America of people living virtuously, living in their community, believing in God, etc. And so what Reagan does is, on the one hand, his rhetoric is conservative. On the other hand, his policies are neoliberal. What he does more than anybody is usher in the era of neoliberalism in this country, in which you turn everything over to the market, and politics becomes the bad guy, government becomes the bad guy. And so it becomes the modus operandi, especially after the Democratic Party forms the Democratic Leadership Conference in order to also appeal to corporate America and sort of joins the same neoliberal game. So that's hugely crucial. Trump, I think what happens with Trump, he sort of uses the same party line, except with a lot more viciousness and a lot more overt hatred or hostility or put-downs of different groups of people who are obviously the bad guys left over from the 60s or their heirs. But I think it works because, probably because of two things. One of which is that the people he's appealing to have been living lives that are really increasingly at risk economically, partly, mainly because of the neoliberal policies that the government has pursued for 20 years. But being blamed for that is the same old people being blamed for that, liberals, progressives, Democrats, whatever, you know, whomever, women, feminists, blacks, all the same kind of targets that the right has been railing about since, well, Nixon anyway.
Yeah, well, he I think one thing is that Reagan, who knows if he would have invited the kind of passion that Trump has playing on those resentments. But at that moment, his sort of easygoingness was a relief from the turmoil of the 60s. Trump, I think, comes in and it's like they're screwing you, and it's going to take more than a warm smile to get them to change. You know, it's going to take more than optimism.
He taps into their anger and resentment, which has been nurtured, fertilized for decades. But I think it's important to point out that the other reason that I think Trump wins is because of the mass media. He does exactly what the media can't help but do. The mass media can't help but do, which is pay attention to outrageousness and extreme behaviors, extreme rhetoric. And so all during that campaign, he is dominating the airwaves, which means that his message, feeding this anger and so forth and resentment, is getting repeated again and again and again.
Yeah. Talk about your book from 2010 is about mass media. I watched this talk you gave in 2011, and it's like you're kind of wrestling with what's happened with what's happening with smartphones and the internet and so on, but it's kind of nascent at that moment. How does what you have been tracking all this time shift, and how does it remain given that for many people, the media is no longer mass? It is based on algorithms, it is individual and so on. We talked about creating these enclaves, but is there even a mass media, and how has that changed what you're looking at?
Well, I think that's a very important question, and I certainly don't have the answer to it. It strikes me that there is still a way in which mainstream, despite Trump, mainstream media continues to operate according to the same boundaries. I think that goes without saying that they do, and we could talk about examples of how they do that. It's sort of the Democrats versus the Republicans, and that's it. Now, what Trump has done is he's mobilized people. Those media have been attacked by the right for decades, and he's mobilizing those people outside of the media. But he's been greatly assisted, and I would say first and foremost by Fox News, and then by the spinoff to the variety of sort of new outlets that have cropped up on social media that are appealing to exactly that population and hyping points of view that are sort of way outside what the mainstream media consider legitimate. I mean, I think the fact that the mainstream media, the New York Times being a classic example, is quite openly critical of Trump shows that he has, in some ways, ventured outside their boundaries to the right rather than to the left. So I think it's a huge dilemma. On the left, there are enormous numbers of outlets that are systemically critical of our institutions, of our foreign policy, of the degree of capitalism, of the degree of inequality in our society, and maybe most importantly of climate change. And calling for the kinds of things that aren't even remotely part of the congressional debate about climate change. So we are in a kind of a crisis in which we have two kind of, if you will, visions or answers of what we need to do in this country that largely lie outside the mainstream media, despite the fact that that's where an awful lot of people still get their news, especially older people. Especially the establishment people, you know, the elites of corporate or political elites.
The elites who have their hands on a lot of the power levers. So, right?
Exactly.
I mean, so yes. what they read and what they believe actually gets done because they're the elites.
Yep.
What do you think of my notion that there is a possibility here of the boomers and older and millennials and younger realizing their similar situations, similar values, and becoming a movement that actually can succeed on climate change, on democracy, on inequality, on systemic racism?
Well, I would say, I think there's validity there that I want to come back to in a moment, but I would say that it strikes me as a little, my initial reaction is it strikes me as a little time-bound. Mm. And it, for me, it echoes conversations that we might have had in 2011 with Occupy and Arab Spring, Wisconsin protest, and so on. It sort of echoes back to the anti-globalization movements around the turn of the century, this century, when it looked like there was a growing mobilization of young and old, but clearly a lot of young, critiquing in pretty fundamental ways our society, the direction the globe is going, and things of that nature. So that's one of my thoughts about that. A second thought about that is that I do think, at the same time, I'm divided between a side of me that is pessimistic and a side of me that is optimistic.
Mm-hmm.
Or I should say, how do I say that? Optimistic.
Well, I'll tell you what. Two different people that I've interviewed recently have said, I'm not an optimist, I'm a possibilist. I'm not optimistic that things will change for the better, but I think it's possible.
Yeah, I remember an interview with James Baldwin said, are you an optimist? And he said, no, I'm not an optimist, but I am hopeful because I'm alive.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for me, what that means is I believe there is in human beings the ability to see beyond themselves and see the larger picture and to connect with other people and to need to connect with other people in ways that can become increasingly aware of how much needs to be done and how bad things really are. And I think that is, in fact, happening. That is, you can see around the world growing mobilizations, whether small or large, of people doing precisely that. So that's the side of me that thinks, you know, especially with something like climate change, which is only going to get more catastrophic unless fundamental change occurs. And I really mean systemic change occurs. Something I could come back to if you felt you wanted to. But on the other hand, I think of how, well, there's the growing authoritarianism, obviously, and that's hugely threatening, I think. At the same time that there's that, there's this ability of people who manipulate through the media, whatever they are, whatever media you were talking about, manipulate others in ways which diverts them from precisely the kinds of awareness that I think human beings are capable of. I would say empathy is the basis for that.
Mm-hmm.
It diverts them away from their empathy for others to concern for themselves or their tribe or whomever against other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the ability, technical and otherwise, to do that successfully has grown substantially since the 60s era. And that worries me a great deal. And then there's the piece of kind of diversion, you know, the distraction of entertainment culture, consumer culture, which continues to pervade. And our economy depends on consumption. We keep getting reminded we need to get out there and buy because otherwise our economy will suffer. Well, that's a very co-optive lesson or message that works very well for people.
Okay, I think we've got to bring this conversation to a close, but I hope that people can see what we've looked at is the 60s, the emergence of the 60s, the response of the mass media and then the larger society to the 60s, and then the potential for the values of the 60s and the systemic questioning and approach to change that is perhaps more necessary than ever. Closing thought.
Yeah. Closing thought. you know, I did talk some about systemic change and systemic problems and use the term radical and so forth. I am one who believes that we on this planet need to figure out a way for a different form of economic organization than capitalism. I think that in the book I talk about how capitalism is fundamentally anti-democratic, or at least supports a kind of democracy that's sort of what we see. But that's almost an unimaginable outcome. You know, it's almost impossible, given how hugely entrenched capitalism is the globe over. How can we even imagine a different system? And I do address that a little bit in the towards the latter part of the book about sort of, I guess, what I would call democratic socialism, which is a form of democracy in which the people, enlightened through education, media, community participation, and else, and likewise, find ways to put constraints on the operation of economic activity the world over, because it has to be the world over. Capitalism will undermine it immediately if not. A market phenomenon which is constrained and works within a democracy rather than a democracy, formal democracy, that works within capitalism. And to think of that globally is pretty staggering.
Yeah.
But who knows? You know, I mean, I don't believe there's another way forward. Well-known sociologist named Emmanuel Wallerstein wrote a book, The End of the World as We Know It. And in the book, he said, we are in a period of 50 years transition from the world historic system, by which he means capitalism, which we have lived under for a couple hundred years or more, into something else. And that something else can be more democratic or it can be less democratic. And in a time of transition, it is possible that people can have a greater effect organizing for change democratically than they could when the system is cruising along and doing this great. So I take some encouragement from
him. Yeah, I mean, I'm reminded of Steve Bannon, that other philosopher, who says we are either going to have... We are going to have a populist revolution. It's either going to be from the left or the right. And that is that the way neoliberalism and the global capitalist system has hurt and frustrated people is going to be responded to, ultimately. Mm-hmm. The question is, which way will it go? We see rising authoritarianism, and we see, movements for positive change. Game on, you know. Okay. Again, the book is What Really Happened in the 1960s. Ted's website is tedmorgan1word.blogspot.com. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 10 articles to flesh out the conversation, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on Apple Podcasts and most major podcast sites, and you'll find years of podcasts there or at my site. Michael Lewis, Naomi Klein, Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle, George Packer. You can also follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. Thanks to Kiana Williams in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely. And finally, thank you, Ted Morgan. Keep up your good work.
Thank you, Terrence. Appreciate it. Good to be with you.
I'm Desi Doyen from BradBlog.com.
And I'm Brad Friedman, also from BradBlog.com.
You're listening to the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
CD quality audio, fewer commercials.
And all your favorite progressive shows.
Like Hartman, Miller, Malloy.
And more.
And instead of local commercials, you hear great features.
Like the Brad Blog's Green News Report.
That is great. No local radio affiliate, no prob. We're mobile.
We are where you are.
So while you're visiting BradBlog.com,
don't forget to listen to Progressive Voices.
And don't forget to spread the word.
Thanks for listening to the Progressive Voices Network, streaming the best in progressive talk 24/7. Keep the progressive conversation going on by joining our community. Each week, we send out an email that covers important things taking place in the Progressive Voices Network and throughout the progressive world. Be the first to know of upcoming shows, schedule changes, exclusive programming, and more. Simply go to progressivevoices.com and sign up for our mailing list. It's that easy. Progressivevoices.com. Thanks for listening, and thanks for joining the Progressive Voices community.